This is Vibrant Spaces, a show about placemaking, activating, and connecting city spaces for the communities you serve. Welcome to another episode of Vibrant Spaces. We are hitting Austin, Texas this week, everyone. Excitement. Oh, we have been trying to get Austin on for ever since season one.
I think we've been trying to get Austin on since like March of 2024.
They are busy people. They have got a lot going on. Not that all of you do not have a lot going on as well. But I am so excited that we finally get to interview them. You guys have probably heard me gushing about the city of Austin and how they handle their cultural placemaking and how they shelve it, put it under the umbrella of like economic development, right? It's this city that's known for creative weirdness, but like there is this structure underneath that really protects the arts from being defunded, right?
And like run through that structure quickly so that people can have a bit of a basis to understand what we're talking with Matthew about.
Yeah. So we originally, when we met with representatives from the city of Austin, we actually met with the UNESCO office. So their UNESCO office, the city of Austin is the UNESCO City of Media Arts, part of a series of creative cities across the globe. But that department was nestled within economic development. And when we got to initially speak to the woman who ran this department, it was very clear that they had actually put the entire department of music, arts and creativity under the economic development branch. Like, to the city of Austin, arts and culture is a main economic driver. The creative economy is one of their tent pillar economies within this city, right? And so they have built the most structured placemaking ecosystem that is an acknowledgement of placemaking and culture as being a strong driver of a city and people's want to move there. Like you saw in the pandemic, tons of companies moving into Austin because of this reputation, which was built off the fact that it is under the umbrella of economic development, and they took it incredibly seriously, and the placemaking that came from that incredibly seriously for probably the past, 15 years now.
I think my favorite example of that in this city is when you arrive in the airport. And I know we pointed it out because we have this lens, but I don't know how many airports everybody has been to or airport parking lots more specifically. So there's a parking structure that's next to the airport in Austin. It has a giant art piece down the middle of it. And in part, we learned that's because you can't build anything new without having music or visual arts as a part of, or some kind of culture placemaking installation piece as a part of what you are doing. So they had to build art in the middle of the parking lot because it changes the entire dynamic of, parking and walking into the city begins with art. In the same way that like you can't go to a city council meeting without hearing live music because they have live music before, in the middle, and after every city council meeting, and they pay the local creators to do that. So those are two of my favorite examples to, throw out for what you just described in the city of Austin that we discovered is when we started to try to get them onto the podcast a couple years ago. And as a part of that, one of the reasons it took so long is they had a lot of internal restructuring. And so we're super excited that today we get to talk with Matthew Schmidt, because he is the head of, I don't know his new title.
It's assistant kind of assistant director, I think assistant, was the, yeah.
Assistant stand-in for the gal we met with originally, Matthew Schmidt. He's the economic and cultural development manager. He has a three next to him on LinkedIn. I don't know what that tier three means, but he's really cool. And he is leading the city of Austin's place-based economic development initiatives and business incentives teams. So identifying strategic investments that provide those opportunities for all businesses and creators within the city. And Matthew thrives where culture and those economics collide. He didn't come from the city of Austin, but he came from a small town and always admired all of the work that the city of Austin has put in to that placemaking. And so he jumped in to kind of help craft the next set of strategies that the city will be employing. And I'm super excited to hear how that work has been going. And as especially if they've been doing that restructure, kind of balancing those equal parts of policy and creative investigation. I'm excited to hear how Matthew really brings that kind of nerdy artsy side of himself and the human loving part of himself to bring this kind of, to carry on the tradition of this local culture of being weird, but also one that's empowered by that economic muscle that Emily was talking about.
Yeah, exactly. And as you're listening to the interview, you know, kind of keep your ears out for the different strategies that they're using. Like, you know, they have this kind of, you know, placemaking matrix, which is a tool that they've kind of developed to get all the city departments speaking the same language about public space, about how that intersects with economics and how that intersects with culture, right? And so it's this beautiful example of UX design and economic development applied to city systems and vibrancy, which you'll hear a lot about in this episode.
One of the other things that you're going to hear, which is super cool, is how they've gone from artist-led and artist-supported systems that they've built. And honestly, Austin has maybe over-systematized the creative process, and that you're going to hear that tension in the heart of the episode. But they really want to help build an ecosystem for artists that supports for artists by artists that supports them, the artists, to thrive in a city that they love, that being Austin, and keeping it weird.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And I think our theme this week is when systems support creativity and when they don't, right? Mm-hmm. And, yeah. You know, I kind of think that this is potentially like Vancouver when it's all grown, like when it's grown up in its current trajectory in a decade, right? You know, it's built a placemaking department. It's really got, you know, it's really furthered. It's like deep dive into data. And I think that the question that we see in the heart of this tension is like, is it still as nimble and joyful once it's grown up? And I think that that's one of the big questions today. So I hope you enjoy this episode with Matthew. We've been really excited to chat to Austin for a long time, and we hope that you enjoy the episode. Matthew, thank you so much for joining us.
Good afternoon. Howdy, Emily, Tim. Thanks for having me.
It's an absolute delight. We have had the pleasure of visiting Austin on many occasions for the South by Southwest Festival.
It's probably fantastic. Fantastic.
in the giant magnet you guys have.
Correct. In fact, I think that the whole Vibrant Spaces podcast was probably built on the fact that we met a whole bunch of city people at South by.
That's beautiful. I can guarantee that.
thank you incredibly for joining us. We're really excited to have you. Let's just dive straight in. You have had a very wide-ranging career in economic development before you stepped into cultural funding. Like it's a, you know, a very different lens to come to cultural landscape and funding with. What was life like growing up? How has your perspective kind of shifted over the years?
I think that's a great question because, I mean, coming from a small town, honestly, economic development really wasn't even in the forefront of my mind thinking that's a possibility or what that profession really was. But I think there was always elements of my life that really instilled what placemaking and culture really meant to the vibrancy of a community, because that's really how community is built. And especially when you're in a small town, you have such personality built around the culture that is just naturally in that area, and the stories. And of course, I was blessed to be from one of our president's hometowns. So of course, there's lots of history and lots of stories that could be shared about those spaces. So as I kind of navigated my life and really found my niche in economic development, I was able to really marry that kind of combination of how do you balance the growth opportunities and economic opportunities for your businesses and your community and your residents, along with just the need for a cultural foundation and celebrating that, especially in such a hyper-competitive environment where you're looking for ways to differentiate yourself from your other communities around you and your competitors for business. So I think that's what was really interesting as I started to really connect connecting those threads throughout my career of how my upbringing actually has influenced kind of my viewpoint and way to implement our place-based economic activities here in the city of Austin, and then just influencing just kind of my economic development career overall.
How many years have you been in Austinite?
I have been in Austin since 2009. So I had always claimed that if once you make that 10-year mark, and I really set that really the bar really high for Austinites to claim whether or not you're from Austin. So now and I still even kind of am unsure if I should claim that I'm from Austin, because there's so many locals that are called unicorns here in Austin that would never allow a transfer like me to claim themselves as being a local, which I totally understand. I think that's where, I mean, especially coming from a small town, I have that hometown pride myself. I will always claim Johnson City as my hometown and wear that with pride. And so I definitely understand people that are very defiant on accepting newbies into their communities.
I mean, that makes sense though. I mean, Austin has had such an influx of people over the past couple of years that I can see that it can be a little bit of a touchy subject, but I mean a decade feels pretty strong to me.
I think so, and I mean I think that's what a lot of people in Austin feel, that they're our slogan, our keep where Austin weird slogan, has always been at threat, because we keep allowing new ideas and influences into our community. And that just changes the shape of what the city of Austin may look like. But I, especially being involved in economic development, accepting and really loving place-based economic development activities, I embrace that diversity of thought. And of course, every community changes and you have to change with it. And there's always ways that you can still preserve that cultural identity that the city has always had, which is very bootstrap, get it done and unique to itself within this kind of diaspora around Texas. But that's what I love about this work, is that you're able to really embrace that kind of that corner of the work and really expand it for the community.
That's really wonderful. I think that, you know, kind of bridging into that place-based conversation, what has been your favorite place in Austin, favorite neighborhood? I'm gonna caveat this. You've now been there for over a decade. What was your favorite place in the beginning, and what has become your favorite place now that you can maybe put that feather in your hat as a Austinite, even if it's just slightly there?
Yeah, I will say, like, and especially when you first move outside of college, you bounce around a lot because you're just like following the affordability in Austin. And when I first moved here, I really lucked out because I lived in a wonderful little spot that was, I think my mom always would joke, she was like, leave it to you to find the most country place in an urban setting to live in. And it was a complex off of a place called Barton Skyway that literally the back door was an entryway into the green belt. So it was just very, very rural setting. But I mean, then you walk a block away and you can see the skyline and you're actually at Zilker Park. So that was really the place that I just fell in love with at first. But then as I evolved my work and really got involved with the city of Austin, my favorite neighborhood, and I mean, of course, I should not claim this, and I should say that all of my districts and all of my neighborhoods are all the same.
Of course I love they them are. The same. All of your children are equally absolutely loved. But you have a favorite.
But it has been, yeah. Right now it's been that our East Cesar Chavez district. And of course, I have really personal ties to it because it is the space that I really started to grind my teeth around place-based economic development and really work with the community in accomplishing a lot of our investments around a public-private partnership, specifically of a project called Hearts on the East Side, which was 10 large public art, essentially, installations that were partnered with local artists to have their own interpretation of just however they kind of felt they wanted to produce within these hearts that somewhat had ties and connections to the district. But it was a wonderful collaboration between our Merchants Association that we have helped build and provide that organizational development support to and support through the city and private property owners to get this established. And so to this day, I mean, 6 years later, there are currently 10 hearts along Cesar Chavez that are still attracting numerous residents that are and walking tours throughout the district. And of course, they're looking to expand on that. So I really love that district. It's always been kind of my special child of making sure that everything goes right with it. And it's been interesting transitioning into this division manager role and then allowing my new staff to kind of lead those efforts. And of course, they are doing an amazing job in stewarding and facilitating those as well.
I definitely would put a thumbs up for that district as well. We, during South by this year, we got to go to I think it was called Cosmic Saltillo. It was like this beautiful bar which was on the tram line that they like reclaimed from an old building, and it, you know, had fountains made out of, you know, half there, like walls from like previous. It was really cool. Like, it was such
so a they're cool. Actually in my second favorite district, I'll claim. They're in my, that's actually within our 5th Street Mexican American Heritage Corridor. So similar, I mean, clearly similar heritage backgrounds, but 5th Street is actually, that was one of my prize projects that I was excited to really get assigned to our economic and cultural district team. Originally, the background of our programs was really focused on fostering economic districts, but because of our success in really leading the strategic planning of those specific spaces, we had some council members say, you know what, we really need someone to support cultural district planning, and we think that y'all can kind of pivot and evolve y'all's models, specifically full cultural districts. And 5th Street Mexican American Heritage Corridor was one of those projects. It had literally been sitting in the city kind of council coffers for since 2011 as being designated a cultural district, but no investment had been made directly into the district to support development of a cultural tourism plan that would help lead them to their state cultural district designation. So seeing that opportunity to be able to shift some of our policy elements and engage with our cultural community, I really jumped on that effort. And it has helped shape our policy that we were able to pass for our community, as well as just establish some new relationships with our cultural partners to see some amazing achievements and milestones get hit. We just recently were able to establish a steering committee for that district, which will then guide them directly towards hopefully achieving their cultural district designation at state level. So some exciting opportunities within that space as well. So two similar districts, and I really do honestly keep them, they're probably tied, honestly, is my favorite neighborhoods right now, just because of the milestones that we've been able to achieve with 5th Street, which is just historic, to get them to where they're at now, and the investments that community has made since 2011 of just keeping at the city and making sure that we invest appropriately and equitably. And then East Cesar Chavez for a whole different host of reasons, just because I love the people, I love the environment. And like I said, I cut my teeth on that district. So taking those lessons learned and then applying them to the 5th Street is what helped, I think, make that area just as successful.
What a beautiful segue into what we really wanted to like focus in on this episode, because our exactly. City of Austin is a city that we have really wanted to have on this podcast for such a very, very long time. And I'm really excited to chat to you about the innovative models that you are building out of Austin. Like a lot of the ways that you fund your cultural programs and build culture into the fabric of your infrastructure just as a city is really, really fascinating. And I know this has a couple of different components, but maybe let's start at the way that you have in the past built culture into the physical infrastructure of Austin, as you know, as both its identity, but also into the physical place itself. And then talk a little bit about how we've now moved on to things like cultural districts and the policies that you're now putting in place there. So how has Austin leveraged the hotel occupancy tax, which for those of you listening at home, called the HOT funds, which winky face there, and other financial tools. How have you leveraged those to build the cultural infrastructure within Austin up until now?
I think that's a great question, especially because of Austin's evolving approach to delivering in these specific initiatives around building its cultural ecosystem. Because originally, and I think this has started, I can't really totally talk historically what the numbers are and how long years wise the city of Austin has approached this, but we've long recognized that the creative economy is our third leg supporting our entire economic ecosystem. And so what the approach was at first our hot funds were being distributed through our parks and recreation department, because most of our cultural centers were specifically on that land, so they thought there was a kind of common tie related to that. But then they had the kind of focus that since our economic development activities were really kind of based on building up our small business in our artist community, that they should shift the cultural arts and cultural affairs activities specifically into economic development. And that's really what's really driven the activities in the city of Austin for the past, I want to say, decade or so, is really economic development policies driven by achieving creative and cultural goals that has been set forth for the community. So every policy or program that we were developing as an economic development department really had a lens of how would that lift up our small business community or support building up our creatives and our creative spaces. So whether that was our incentive programs like the business expansion program that would support job creation for small businesses and then give community benefit points to whether those businesses were either investing in the cultural infrastructure around that specific community or whether it was specifically achieving a community benefit in itself of providing additional creative space or affordable creative space in our city. And then, of course, the programs have evolved just by what community has demanded. And one of those programs was, of course, our district and our economic and cultural district policy, because back in 2016, there was such a kind of a swelling of need for community organization within these specific geographies. And they didn't really know how to organize themselves and really support themselves in a way that would advocate for the changes and the policies that were needed to preserve these spaces. So our department took it upon ourselves to develop the Solely Austin program, which really focused on delivering those kind of that three-pronged approach, which was really community organization, organizational development, and then strategic planning, which would lead to the implementation of fantastic programs and policies that have now been able to help preserve some of these places, like our creative district combining overlay, which again is just all these tools are really focused on trying to provide affordable creative space to our cultural fabric. And then now the city of Austin has now pivoted once again to delivering our cultural programs through a specific office called the Office of Arts, Culture, Music, and Entertainment, which they really did recognize that at this point in kind of the world, I think, is that economic development, especially in the way the city of Austin was approaching it, needed to kind of pivot a little bit more and focus on a little bit more of our corporate expansion and recruitment and just retention policies, and then give arts, culture, music, and entertainment its own platform that while it's still rooted in making sure that we are delivering an economic impact and return to our city when we're reinvesting these hot funds into our artist community and driving up tourism, but that we are now able to really focus on delivering metrics focused on the arts and culture, which was a story that we were getting kind of muddled with our economic development impacts, which were really just how many jobs did you create? And you can't really explain culture and art and the number of jobs. You can. I always do asterisks that because I'm still an economic developer at heart. And I always know that when I go to policymakers, I need those numbers to really demonstrate the impact. But there is so much more qualitative data when you're working with culture and arts and how it impacts the everyday experience of an individual that you have to kind of take into account when you're trying to push some of those initiatives forward. So I'm excited to see the direction that the city of Austin is going, really to lift up a specific department and office that focuses on these initiatives. And that's really where we're at right now. As you talked about really innovative delivery, we're actually going through another entire, what we're calling the creative reset, which is really refocusing on how we deliver our hot funds to, or reinvest those hot funds back into our city. With such a limited amount of funding, we have about $17 million annually to provide hot funds back into our creative economy. And we have typically around $80 million in requests from our organizations and individual artists looking to utilize those fundings for their next project, or whether it is to support their organization operationally and try and bring them to what we consider an institutional level. We are now trying to reimagine how we deliver those programs. And it was all, as I've said, an evolving kind of process to getting us there, because it feels like our cultural funding programs pretty much go through a new iteration every 3 years. And if we're just responding to community and what they are actually needing to support their programs. 3 years ago, we were really focused on racial equity and going and meeting our community where they were at, especially as they're coming out of COVID, to understand how do you want to see our hot funds distributed into community. And they said they wanted to see funding disrupted, because initially all of these funds were going to legacy organizations that had accessed the programs for years and that historically underrepresented individuals had not been able to get their foot in the door. So we were able to make those pivots, but what we've found is that we've unintentionally made some decisions that maybe have damaged some of our larger organizations that actually help build and maintain the creative ecosystem within the city of Austin. So we're working with community to revisit what our programs looked at, like doing a reflection of what the impacts have been and how can we make some specific pivots into the programs and deliver them at a critical time as organizations are losing federal and state funding from NEA and NEH. So it's an exciting time to see what community will really let us know how we can try and utilize these funds in an appropriate way that will impact the community in the most in the largest impact overall, and leverage what those organizations and individual artists can bring to the city of Austin.
There's a lot to unpack there. I love it so much. I love it. It's amazing. So there's a couple of things that I definitely want to touch on there. I want to touch on the change, obviously, to the new department, and I do want to have a touch on how you're moving into those, like, splitting of funds and all of that into the future. So I do want to touch on those two points. I want to revisit a little bit. So it sounds like a lot of the that splitting of economic development and culture has come from that opportunity that COVID kind of brought in, right? So, like, you had initially started with using these kind of hot funds and building into, because I know that you have several programs around if things are developed, if there's a development or an infrastructure project in the city, part of that has to go towards at least some form of public art or some kind of, like, building of the infrastructure. I remember walking through the airport in Austin, coming across this, like, art installation and being like, oh, this is a very odd place for an art installation to be, and then finding out that that's because, like, it's mandated as part of your policies in the city that, like, infrastructure happens, but culture has to happen as part of that infrastructure. And so it sounds like that HOT was really, you know, it obviously relied on that hotel occupancy. It really relied on that to be able to bring in that $17 million to build out that culture. And so I'm curious as to, being under that economic development lens and having that eye on how culture brings money into the city, pre-COVID, what were the things that HOT was, how did you go about distributing those HOT funds, regardless of whether the fact that it went to legacy or individual artists, like, how did that distribution happen? And then now that you are kind of post-COVID, how are you building those new revenue streams to augment that HOT fund? I'm really interested in that component before we move on to the new department.
Absolutely. I think that's a really great question. I think the way that we had originally distributed our hot funds was really focused on project-based activities and really just whether those organizations were producing a public-facing activity that could increase tourism. So there is a hot statute on a state level that kind of restricts what activities the hot funds can be utilized for. And it all directly ties back to tourism. But if you, I think you could go community by community, and they have just a little bit slightly tweaked different definition of how that hot definition of hot funds work. And the city of Austin, just historically, because of the kind of proverbial target on our back that we've always had from the state, we try and stay as closely aligned with that statute as possible. So there was a lot of restrictions the way that we have approached the cultural funding programs of delivery. And that really just meant we felt like as long as we met some of the metrics that were identified between our Texas Commission on the Arts, or our, I think it was our nonprofit Texans for the Arts organization, had made an agreement with the Texas hotel lodging industry that kind of identified the metrics that would strengthen why we would spend hot funds on tourism related activities. And that was really just in kind of counting attendance numbers. And again, it just, it wasn't telling the full story of the impact of what these dollars were really generating, but it was a very, I would say a very state-driven identification metric of what they believed could.
It feels like a very economic-driven metric as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's what I would say, state-driven, because like they have their blinders on of just like, we're policymakers, we want numbers.
And it's Texas. So, and as you look at those pieces, as a non-Texan, can you maybe explain what some of those parameters would have looked like? Because a lot of the questions that I know people have is, you know, you've had a target on your back because people want to be in Austin. Cities around the country want to be like Austin. And so can you potentially give us what, you know, the rules that you worked within, but then maybe some suggestions of like lessons from those hot funds, right? Because you've obviously gone through a transition and you have already walked us through like these are the different stages of our transitions as we've learned to use these hot funds. If you were to give like a top five tips, right? So as well. So can you give us like, here are the rules that we had to work within because we're in Texas, but then here are the five tips from these multiple iterations or transformations or this metamorphosis that you guys have been through. I'd love to kind of grapple around that because I know that people who are listening are wanting to do what you guys have done. And if they can maybe take lessons from the last 15 years of iterations, that would probably be a super boon for anyone listening to this podcast.
Yeah, I can definitely try and give top five tips or anything, but
overall, it's a challenge, so go for it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like, but I, with the state of Texas, of course, the main statute really just drives and makes sure that the funding that is generated by hotel occupancy taxes is either spent to support activity that would be increasing tourism around the convention center of that specific community, or just generates dollars to increase tourism activity in general. But there are
Can I pause you? Is that where South by Southwest and like Austin, like the music festivals and pieces that you guys host, do you draw funding from that for, or do you like, can you count those as boxes checked for the state with those large conferences that come in? Is that why Austin's focused so heavily on being a space for those events?
So those events are what generate and help us drive up the hot collections. And so the more heads and beds we can bring into our community, that is where the tax comes in and provides us more money to reinvest into that. I believe that the hotel occupancy tax, and I think the breakdown is that 11% of that initial, there's a tax that 11% of it goes towards the state, and then another portion of that will come back and be reinvested to the city. And we actually share that hotel occupancy collections among several different buckets of funding, which the main majority of that is actually the convention center fund, which is supporting the operations and actually the redevelopment of our convention center, which is currently under demolition, which we know is going to impact our Hawk collections. But that is where, of course, we as a city want to support the events like South by Southwest and ACL and any other larger events that may be occurring in the city, because that will support more collections of Hawk funds, so that we have the flexibility to do what we can with our funding. And that is really kind of going back to some of the questions we'd asked earlier. The struggle that the city of Austin has is that we only rely on our hot fund collections right now in distributing and supporting our creative ecosystem. And we are, I think that's what's exciting about us stepping into this new department, is a really ability for us to focus on diversifying that portfolio of revenues, because that will really allow us to unlock the ability to be a lot more flexible with the delivery of our dollars. Within the state statute, of course, and of course, state legislation right now in the environment we're in, there's been legislation that's really focused on eliminating diversity, equity, and inclusion measures throughout either the offices that may support that work within our municipalities, and or just to the delivery of programs that tried to focus on those. And that was something that, talking about things that we've done a really great job of at the city of Austin, of kind of trying to achieve specific measures around racial equity with the delivery of our programs. That was something that was really focused through our community engagement efforts and told to us by our community through the cultural funding review process, that they wanted to see us really redirect these funds to our historically underrepresented communities. But now we're being challenged, and that's another reason why we're going through this evolution of how our funding has been. But we did a really good job of initially, when we kind of revealed this new dynamic or structure of how to deliver these programs to really focus on BIPOC organizations or our LGBTQI plus organizations. It was just really creative legal language, and working closely with our lawyers to make sure that the language met state statute requirements and didn't draw enough attention to us to really try to say that we were running afoul of how we were distributing funding. But now, of course, legislators, catch wind of our tricks and they start reacting accordingly. And so with this federal and state environment of shifting language again towards removing that ability for us to distribute funds in that specific way, we are now revisiting the programs to determine what are the layered types of questions that we can ask to still get the funds into these organizations' hands and still achieve the goals that a community had shared with us a few years ago. But the way that we deliver it is going to be a little bit more innovative. And that's why we're working very closely with community, because the city of Austin, unfortunately, I always say, I think it's a fortunate problem to have, but it's also unfortunate because our geography is so dispersed amongst the city that we have such a mix of our lower income individuals and organizations mixed in with our higher income individuals and organizations, that it's hard for us to geographically target specific areas in our community to really achieve the goals that we're looking at. So that's why we're needing to work closely with community to really identify what is that complex set of questions that's contextual to your community that will really identify the needs of our underrepresented communities beyond just asking how many years have you received funding from the city of Austin and how can we really kind of shift the narrative that way. It's really trying to understand beyond as many years as you've connected with the city of Austin and funding, how have you been able to kind of impact and leverage those funds to expand your operations or get yourself a little bit more stabilized so that you're not always relying on these restricted funds within HOT. But that's why we're also exploring now with the new department, what are the philanthropic donors and foundations within the city of Austin that we can start making new relationships with? Because we have really seen that is something that's lacked in the city of Austin, is a strong donor foundation type organizations to really support our arts communities. And being the city is being the lead funder, we can start those conversations and we can start trying to unlock those types of revenue streams that could help diversify our ability to achieve different goals. Another wonderful organization that supports the city of Austin is our Health Alliance for Austin Musicians. And while it would be wonderful for us to support an organization like that, our hot funds are restricted that we cannot utilize our funding to provide general health care needs for our Austin musicians. But we recognize that that is a critical need of maintaining our artists within our community, is being able to have healthy artists and creatives within our community. But the only way we could really support those types of organizations is if we look at diversifying the funds beyond these hot funds that are statutorily restrictive on a state level. So lots of things for us to look at, and we're excited to kind of explore what
we can do. Yeah, I'd like to make sure that you don't rely just on hot funds. Like, diversify early, it sounds like, is like tip number one, is diversify those streams early, so that when you talk to your community about the ways that you want to diversify your programs, so that it's not just large programs, it's not just physical infrastructure, public art, and it allows for a diversity of things that, like, you can pull from a diversity of pools, both philanthropic, but also, you know, maybe corporate, and then from there you can kind of build out your policies and structures, but also acknowledging the fact that there are multiple enclaves of culture in an area. And so how do you make sure that you're respecting the fact that the city of Austin is not just the downtown of Austin?
Yeah, I would say I'd throw in there too, like, it sounds like really your first step was understanding your requirement of funds. Step two was speaking and engaging your community. Three was building up those private nonprofit pieces. And then four was, you're okay, we now know what our limits are, who we're serving, who can help us, time to diversify that build. And then everything that Emily just said, like, I feel like those, did we miss anything? As like, those seem like some amazing tips.
Yeah. Number five is kind of built into engaging your community, is just setting expectation and managing those expectations. I think that is always something very critically missed at times, especially in municipal engagement. We go out into community, and especially in urban planning, this is what I feel like, we always go out into community and we dream up big ideas and we promise the world of these big visions, but most of those visions are not implementable and actionable within the city's constraints. So that is something that I think we've been really successful at from our economic and cultural district planning perspective, is that when we engage our community, yes, we're asking for those big, bold ideas, but we're also managing the expectations of what can be achieved within the constraints of the city, but also allowing those big, bold ideas to kind of build out if we recognize the correct partnerships that are out in community. Because I think that's what our lack of trust sometimes happens between community and your municipal leaders, because we want to be open and we want to get all the feedback, but we don't let them understand what is actually going to be implementable at the end of the day. And then they feel disappointed in the end product because they don't see themselves. I'll always remember this idea of a big giant Ferris wheel in a park here in the city of Austin. And I'm just like, that's probably never going to happen. But here we have all these amazing conceptual drawings of a beautiful park with a Ferris wheel. And I just know that those community members that voted on this, I'm going to say it, ridiculous idea of a Ferris wheel in this park. But the fact that it may not come to fruition will just continue to erode trust between community and municipal planners. And then that activity of planning those areas will get just less and less involvement from our stakeholders that were needed to really achieve the results we want.
I think the other two learnings that I have out of what you just told us as well, that really I would like to pull out, is that you kind of mentioned how, you know, you use the example of asking the question, how long have you engaged with the city of Austin and gotten funds from the city of Austin, as being kind of like, that can't just be the only question. But I think that that also brings up a key thing that you guys are thinking about, which is that having organizations and creators reliant on funding is never good for anyone. And so making sure that we build in, whether it's processes or education programs, that allow for those institutions to be able to, yes, maybe start with that funding, but over the years be able to wean themselves off it so they become self-sufficient, right? And particularly when the funding landscape is so up and down and you never know what funding might be cut or brought back in, it's really important to make sure that you're building and helping people build that self-sufficiency. And that's definitely a very economic development mindset, right? And I think that that's why Austin has been so successful, is it's acknowledging the entrepreneurship of creativity and pushing people to look at how they can be sustainable for themselves, right? Which I think that I has been so effective for you guys. And the other thing being that the acknowledgement of how creators, a lot of the time in the grant funding process, are expected to give a lot of in-kind. And as a result of giving in a lot of in-kind as part of projects, they miss out on things like health care, for example, and acknowledging that if your city is so reliant on the fact that it is culturally vibrant and viable, that you need to make sure that those support systems are in place for that cultural vibrancy to continue, and that people are not lacking basic things like healthcare as part of that. And I think that those two call outs are really interesting things that I'm seeing you guys really focus on at the moment.
I think your first part was perfect about a conversation I had literally with my division managers just a second ago, was just about the crossover and supports that we really are needing to increase in building the resiliency of our organizations and individual artists within our community. And that's where a lot of our support does come from, our small business team within the Economic Development Department, because they offer trainings and that we have been able to contribute the topics that we would really like them to see build out. And so there are specific classes that are geared towards our artist community or our nonprofit community and helping them establish their organizations. And additionally, through the economic and cultural district work that I've been involved in, we had a specific legal contract with an organization that would be able to provide trainings around any kind of organizational development topic that for a nonprofit that we could think of. So we have this library of trainings that we've been geared towards our economic and cultural districts. And just today, as we were talking about how can we continue to find innovative ways to build the resiliency of our creative ecosystem? That's when that light bulb popped over my head, and I was like, why aren't we leveraging this contract to offer more support to our grantees that are coming through our programs? While we have done some innovative ways of looking at specifically our Thrive program, once you're a grantee in a specific year, you then enter into a cohort where we host on a regular basis meetings where all of those grantees can get together and network and build upon best practices to increase their organizational capacity and impact. This type of a contract would then be offered to all of our programs and all of our grantees that can continue to kind of build upon that theme of how do we really support the organizational development, so that since we have such a restrictive number of funds, that they can finally get to that graduated level of not needing to be supported by municipal funds, and they can kind of start diversifying on their own and being an independent organization, and we can continue to grow the new generations of organizations that are coming up.
Yeah, that's wonderful, and that seems to be a very core part of the cultural districts program that you have been spearheading. The thing that I have spoken to a lot of people about that I had loved about the city of Austin was that because of that acknowledgement of the economic potential of creativity and how that kind of nestled under the Economic Development Department, it seems like you guys got so much more established and done because culture was sitting under economic development. But you mentioned that basically those departments are separating now, and they're separating basically because, you know, things feel like they're muddying. But I'd love you to maybe round off this episode by talking about how or why those separation of departments is happening at this point in time, and where you see that going as creatives, and how they can engage with you over the next, say, 3 to 5 years.
Absolutely. And if you could, as you answer that, if you could like throw in the UNESCO and Soli Austin piece, and how does it affect your UNESCO piece, all of these transitions and changes, is it gonna, like, what's gonna happen to UNESCO Austin?
That's a great question. And I think that's what's a wonderful opportunity. Really, the impetus of the split was actually identified in a creative Austin cultural tourism plan that was developed back in 2015. Community had actually been asking for a separate office of arts, culture, music, and entertainment for many, many years. And there had always been an internal kind of barrier to achieving that because we recognized that it would eliminate some resources that we could actually deliver to community because most likely we would have to redirect some hot funds to help for the administrative side. I mean, that's all the dirty laundry stuff of administrative work on a municipal level. But it is something that needed to be clear to community that it wasn't, we were trying to just not accept one of their recommendations. It was truly looking at it from a fiscal standpoint that we're still a small department with a small amount of funds that are distributed to our community. So we want to be as fiscally responsible as we can be. But that swell of demand continued to kind of drum up around community. And as we've shifted into a new city management team, but they looked across the country and to really look at best practices. And they noticed that most communities have a separate cultural affairs department, which is focused on delivering the needs of a cultural community. And they recognize that that's while there are those economic impacts, it's a little bit slightly different. And that was what was coming from community, that they felt the need that to be a separate entity because the metrics and the storytelling that came out of an economic development department was not truly telling the impact of what art was doing to community and what culture brought to community. So that's where I really saw the new city manager kind of step in, listen to our community members and take action quickly to determine that that was the route that the city of Austin needed to go, was to really see a split with those efforts. And then what I think it really does is help lift up some of those designations that we have. So as you referenced the UNESCO designation that we had since 2016, the city of Austin has been a designated UNESCO Creative Cities for Media Arts. And I believe that we're the only United States community with that designation. And so, of course, we hold that really highly within our department and within our city because we want to be known as a global community amongst all of our partners. And so now with this new department, we can really highlight our partnership with our UNESCO organization and our steering committee and really start to tell that story. I think that was something also that was kind of lacking within our economic development department was just communicating some of these achievements. And that was one thing that I will say I struggled with is, again, being an economic development member at heart, I just knew that we weren't communicating our story, that our economic development department was achieving a lot of great milestones for our creative and cultural economy because, as I said, every policy that we were developing was rooted in culture, but we weren't communicating that appropriately to our community to demonstrate the impacts directly. But now we have this specific department that'll really be able to celebrate the stories, celebrate the history and the kind of background of our artists that we're engaging with, and really refocusing what are the priorities of the city of Austin wants to achieve around our arts, culture, music, and entertainment industries.
See, yeah, I think that the one thing that I would, I suppose, challenge your team in is that the one fear that I would have about separating those two is that, as you said, like the economic the flow of economic development funds generally follows numbers, right? And so I think that your key challenge is going to be in the education that you give to the community and the policies that you set up, that you don't, creators don't like being held to numbers and they want that story to be told. And I think that, as you say, it's necessary to split them so that that story can properly be told from the department. But at the same time, don't let them get away with not doing numbers because the numbers will be what gets the additional funding in from other places. And like, and so it, and so your challenge will be integrating that into the education so that they know that even though it makes them uncomfortable, that just quantifying things even slightly increases their chances of getting additional funding by like magnitudes. And I think that will be where your challenge lies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. That's something, or go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead and respond, then I have another thought.
I was just going to say, like, absolutely. That's some of the work that we're already doing, specifically in our economic and cultural districts, was really, while we know that they're generating tons of activity through their cultural programming, we had just had never done the economic impact studies that we could internally control, so that's not bothering our creative community, but that we can monitor as best as possible. And that's something that we just recently produced, and that will continue to help build and kind of help inform the way that we approach our investments on an equitable level. And that, as you said, is a great storytelling kind of tool for us as well, because now we have the data that when we start engaging with these districts or even future districts, we can demonstrate to them, look at the impacts on a revenue scale or a sales scale for your retail businesses that this type of programming can bring into your area, especially if you have a wonderful story rooted in culture and place that you can kind of combine into those efforts. So I, of course, again, since I have economic development always at my heart, that is where I always know secretly in the background, I'm going to have to keep those quantified numbers. While I will always engage with our creative community and ask for those qualitative stories that impact our data as well. But making sure that we tell that story appropriately so that we can make real strides moving forward with our policymakers.
Is that a public facing kind of policies reports? Can we share that with listeners on the pod?
The specific report on... Mm. I mean, we haven't really developed that yet. I'm just saying that's my dream specifically.
Okay, that's your dream. Okay, I love it. Because if you as a team have developed that report, I would love to be able to.
We are currently going through with our new department. That is the one thing that we were lacking specifically in an economic development department and a ACME department was really community-driven metrics demonstrating our impact. So that's what's really exciting during this strategic or creative reset is that we are also doing strategic planning for this new department, which is, of course, we're setting up a new department. We should be going through this, is really identifying with community, what is it that you want the goals of this department to really achieve? And then what are the measurable impacts that we can then demonstrate that impact so that they can see that we're continuing to meet those milestones and thresholds that they've set forth for us. And then, of course, tying it all the way back to all of the strategic plans that the city of Austin has developed for us as well, so that we achieve our complete communities and other cultural milestones that they've set forth for us.
Yeah. To me, it really sounds like you are identifying audience. If I was to put like a startup spin on it, is that your audience for the longest time sounds like it's been government, it's been these larger institutions, and you've recognized that your audience is truly your creators and that they need that kind of data feedback loops to empower them to continue to do their jobs and see the impact that they're having. And I think that that's wonderful. And so it really leads me to kind of a question to really round off and close out this episode is that if I was a creator in the city of Austin, what could I expect to engage in the next 3 to 5 years? Like what would your dream status be of Tim is coming to Matthew to, I don't know, I have a giant thing I'd like to install in one of the parks. Let's just call it a Ferris wheel. I'd love to make it happen. And how would that engagement process work? What would I be required to kind of contribute? And like, what would I want that impact to be like? Can you describe all of that as like a creator coming to Matthew wanting to do this art piece, engaging with the city? What can I expect?
I think that's what's really exciting about the goals of the Office of Arts, Culture, Music, and Entertainment is really to become a one-stop shop for all of our cultural and creative community so that any idea that they're bringing forth to the city, we can find an avenue to support them. So within our entire new department, we have our cultural funding programs, which is our direct grant programs to our creative communities and cultural artists. We have a live music fund. That's something that's very unique within the city of Austin that's specific. Set up. It's supported by our hot funds, but of course it's directly driven to support our performance venues and the sustainability of those musicians that support the local musicians that support those, as well as a heritage preservation fund.
Is the music fund the one that is the music fund the one that like the city council meetings have music performances in the in like in the middle and the end?
That is just that an extra program that we do on our own through our own programming efforts.
Because you're so cool. Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely. That's exactly it. And that's it's expanded even from our performances at City Hall on council days to actual performances that are recorded and are played during our music commission. So we try and do some programming that we can internally control with our ATXN partners like that, and then our local musicians to just highlight the fact that the city of Austin is the live music capital of the world. And we'll maintain that no matter what.
I love it. I love the confidence of that.
That's what I was like, I have right. to, because especially as one of the gatekeepers with our cultural districts, like that's some of those mantras and mottos of our community that I really want to maintain. I mean, I always laugh that some people that move in early were like, oh, that Keep Austin Weird motto is just so overplayed and it's in the 1970s. I was like, no, that's something that we still need to embrace. Austin is a little bit weird about how we approach things, but the way that we're weird about it is innovative and it achieves great results to our community at all the time.
I definitely agree on that. So it sounds like it's going to be a combination of grants, but it's also going to be a combination of projects that the city itself is maintaining and initiatives that it's kind of spearheading. And that sounds like a beautiful, flexible combo in a way that a city that is just locked in to the granting programs of one particular thing under one particular mandate doesn't necessarily get.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like I said, one-stop shop for any kind of idea and delivery. And that's what we're really meant to do. And that's something that I really loved about our economic and cultural district team is that we really do serve as ombudsman just for our community. And I think it goes back to some of the comments we've made. Really everything, what I've loved about the approach that we take with the City of Austin, our place-based initiatives, is that it is rooted in community vision. And without community partners, it is not achievable. And it's not sustainable in the long run. So that's really just what I've really instilled in my team and the programs that we develop is making sure that community involvement is at the highest levels in achieving those goals. And that's what I love to see about this new department is that we are now going to have essentially a team, while they're not specifically ombudsman, but there are ombudsman for those specific programs. But as you said, a creative comes into our office, we are able to quickly direct them within our own department who is going to support their dreams of whether it's going to be installing a new public art piece within our public property, whether they're wanting to rent out one of our cultural centers for a performance, or whether they're just seeking grant funding to produce a cultural product within our community that just continues to make, as I said, Keep Austin Weird, because some of these productions are pretty out there and wild.
And so when you say that you're engaging with your community, that can mean a bunch of different things. What does that mean for you guys specifically?
For us, it's making sure that community is hand in hand with us and making decisions within our program decisions, especially during this creative reset and strategic planning effort. It's identifying, and it's really going out wide and deep into community. Because that's something.
Once a month, or like how does that kind of like manifest?
Currently, it's been through surveys, focus groups, one-on-ones. Mm-hmm. We have an extensive, and I think that's one thing that the City of Austin has gone through a lot of community engagement fatigue. So we have extensive contact lists, but of course, we're trying to do as deep engagement as possible because there are so many voices that are unheard in these processes. And we recognize that there are those individuals in our community that have the time and ability and capacity to go to city council and voice their concerns. But then there is a whole swath of community that is needing to be represented because they are tirelessly working to survive on their own and they don't have that time to advocate on their own. So we want to meet them where they are. So we always look at trying to diversify the ways that we are doing outreach into community. Like I said, whether it's a survey, focus group, one-on-ones, as well as ensuring that there's language access to all of these materials, since we are a diverse community in terms of demographics. But it's just trying to look at any avenue that's possible out there. I know that there had been some desire, especially now as we've moved into such a digital social media age, it was how do we utilize TikTok and Instagram into reaching our audiences, which I'm still probably a late adopter because I was like, I would never be talking to my municipal government through a TikTok, but people probably do it nowadays. But that's some of the stuff that we're always looking at to try and innovate around and reach new audiences.
Love that. I was going to say my local city has been using TikTok Reels to announce the completion of dog parks, to announce the launching of like art, street art campaigns, like apply here. And I'll be honest, because that's where I'm living when I'm laying in my bed at night. That's when I get to see, you know, what the city actually is proposing. So I might encourage that late adoptionness within yourself to embrace the millennial Zers who are that future of your city, who might that's be those true. Artists the next 3 to 5 years. Yeah,
absolutely.
Because that's where they are, you know, 24/7 is in that little box in our pockets. Okay, with that, I think I want to, it has been an amazing conversation, and I kind of want to move us to a close here. And so with that, I mean, what do you think is like the, if you were to name like a single habit that has made the city of Austin better, like whether it's a belief or a habit that has improved over the years that another city should start implementing tomorrow, what would it be?
I really think from my own personal perspective, it's really just tirelessly working with your community and being as involved as possible with them and ensuring that you're delivering information to them in a timely manner. I think that is something that is in most governments, what I've experienced is that there's a government employee syndrome of just a slower pace to achieving the goals. And especially in economic development, we don't have that luxury. We are working with community members or businesses. And that's what our creative ecosystem is these are businesses and this is their livelihood. And we need to respect that they are in dire needs, especially at this time. So when they're outreaching to us for assistance, we need to always deliver and respond in a timely manner. And that is something that I am always very clear with my team and the individuals that I work with and support and mentor, is that just being that responsive individual will help build a sense of trust amongst your community. And then they will always want to come to you for implementation of their ideas or changes because they've built that trust with that government individual that they know they can always go to. That's what I've loved about our economic and cultural districts, because we are problem solvers for any single matter that they have, whether it's a zoning issue or whether they're looking for funding for their next cultural event within their spaces. We're there to help support them and facilitate any of those conversations. So I know it's always, you always balance that conversation about work-life balance, but I always recognize to be really successful in the economic development and cultural development fields, you have to recognize that this is a 24/7 hour job with your stakeholders, because of course their creatives are up at all different hours of the night and day. Mm-hmm. So you have to meet them where they're at and just being flexible. So that's always the advice I give my staff and anyone that really looks to see why I feel like I have made it to the level that I have had in my career, is just always being a partner with our community members and making sure that they feel heard and responded to in a timely manner so that we can together achieve solutions.
That is beautiful. I love that as a rounding off point to this conversation. Matthew, thank you so much for joining us, particularly when I know that everything has been up in the air in the city, and so to be able to take us through that like messy transition period, which is always a difficult thing, whether you're a city or not, we just really appreciate you spending the time here with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I felt like that little meme of the dog that's drinking his coffee saying it's fine and the fire is just occurring all around me. That's what I feel like is currently going on with the city of Austin. But I feel like after any new fire, there's always new growth. And that's just exactly what we're experiencing with this new office. So there's an exciting opportunity. I really appreciated just sharing that story and sharing kind of how we've gotten to that point and the way that we've been able to deliver and support our creative ecosystem as well. So thank y'all so much for having me.
And I think that it's a testament to why Austin is the leader that it is because you guys don't just set up a program and then leave it for two decades. Like you are constantly iterating and it's just wonderful to see. So thank you.
Yeah. There's no stopping our creative community.
No. And I think there's no stopping you guys supporting them as you, I don't think I've heard the words, feedback fatigue yet. I don't think we've had a community feedback fatigue. Anybody mentioned that? And that just really speaks to how much you guys engage with the people you serve. So it's been awesome to hear all about it. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
That was both incredibly fascinating and also kind of disappointing because we were super excited headed into that call. But Em, you walked us through, like we've been so excited about coming and talking to Austin for a very long time and we knew changes were happening. I would love to hear your thoughts on those changes. And I'm gonna hold my tongue as long as I can, but I'd love to hear your thoughts first and foremost.
I love Matthew and the team there.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they've had many consultants come in and they have consulted. It's clear that they have deeply consulted with their community. Mm-hmm. But if I was the god of the city of Austin, I wouldn't have split the department as they are currently
why?
Doing.
Tell us why.
To me, that move risks undoing the inbuilt protection and shield that helped them thrive for the past 15 years. Because when you treat the arts and culture as an economic driver, you safeguard them. Like safeguard them from budget cuts that hit standalone arts departments, right? Like yeah. Austin has, you know, most cities rely very heavily on grants and are vulnerable to political shifts. And like Austin very smartly embedded culture into the economic system, which made defunding it quite difficult without backlash. And so I worry about them splitting it out.
Okay, I worry, and I find the timing of this fascinating because, and hear me out, just because, like, is this a reflection of everything else that we're seeing in Texas right now? And I say that because they are, one of the things that we've seen from a Story City business lens over the last, I don't know, probably since like October of last year, November of last year, really, is the pullback from arts and culture and public placemaking underneath a number of different city administrations and municipalities across the country due to the fact that diversity, equity, and inclusion funding has been cut. And I find it fascinating because I feel like Austin was safe because of their economic development bubble. And this feels like they're trying to pull arts and culture out of this shield and stick it into this thing where we're seeing funding systematically be cut for DEI and Texas helping be the tip of that spear in the United States. And Austin being the capital of Texas, I have a lot of questions because the humans are in the same space. They're all eating around the same tables. So,
okay, so there might be an element of that. I love your conspiracy theory. And it's not to say that it's not actually legit happening in other places. And like, again, we're seeing it in later episodes in this season and whatnot. But I do know that the city of Austin started this process well before the election. Like they were talking about doing this in March of 2024. Like it was already in motion then. So it had already been happening. Mm. And like Austin is a very, very, very liberal pot. Like pocket of Texas. And so yes, like the Capitol building's there and all of that kind of thing, but like the people that we have spoken to in the city are the most liberal bent of Texans. And I think that that's probably, like, my guess would be No, because this was started well before.
Okay. Even though the head of Doge himself lives there, like I'm just, you know, it's that's where
you cannot stop rich people from moving wherever the fuck they want. All right, like this is not on the city of Austin. What's on the city of Austin is being too good at being cool that they attracted
the well. Okay, so yes. Taking a breath away from my conspiracy. Yeah.
Yes, like it's yes. So like I think that that's probably like, I mean, and you know U.S. systems and politics much better than I do, but I'm pretty sure that they had triggered this quite a fair bit before the new administration. I do have one final thing though that I want to like just to close out this thought is that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, my very strong stance, I would not have split this department. I would have kept it under the protection of economic drivers. But in saying that, if anybody could pull this off, the splitting out, like, because obviously, like, they, so the city of Austin clearly see that them, their arts department being under economic development has become an issue for them. Right, like after 15 years of doing this and advancing models, like they're like sure. they're obviously seeing the issues with what we see to be like one of the better systems in the US, right, for placemaking and cultural development and building a vibrant city. So they obviously deep in and they see issues that maybe we don't see because we're just like, oh my god, revolutionary. Yeah. But like, if anyone could do this split and not lose vibrancy as a result of that, I would bet my money on the city of Austin team and Matt's team, right? Because they have this DNA, like this cultural economic infrastructure DNA built into them from having done this for a very significant time, for 15 to 20 years. And so they've had that protection, which has allowed them to change the culture. And now we have these key people that understand economic development who are still going to be sitting underneath this new arts department. Right. And so that culture is not going to change. And so, like, I wouldn't recommend this model for cities who don't have this cultural DNA and that they probably should protect it under the umbrella until they have a decade, you know, behind.
As long as we're naming it, you know?
Yeah. Like, right. Like, like once you have a decade of having changed this culture so that everyone in the city is thinking this way, like, and that, and they're looking at that lens. But I think that if it was anyone else that had like only had their arts and culture under the economic development for a very short amount of time, I don't know whether they will be able to pull it off in the way that Austin will potentially be able to pull it off.
Okay. So I'll concede to that. I'll concede that Austin has the maturity. Like if I'm going to like rank, I'll just rank last episode and this one. If last week's episode was like a late teens just becoming an adult, figuring out space, and then like Austin is somewhere in their late 20s, they're still growing. And so I'll give that to you that they're finding a system that'll work for them and that they do have the capacity to potentially pull it off. But I think that my challenge with that and acknowledging them, and this is a part of acknowledging that they're not an 85-year-old, right? And that's important here, is that the split they're claiming is about transparency for people. But if they were truly being transparent, the community, the local community, would understand that what the value of the UNESCO designation for a city of media arts is. And I think that part of that challenge is that half of that local community, as you mentioned before, is new to the city. Mm-hmm. How many of those tech people were not raised underneath the Keep Austin Weird mentality, and they just, things aren't functioning the way that they think it should be. And so their voices are now a part of that. So the city of Austin is really, the community has shifted and changed as well, especially since COVID, especially since all of those companies have moved there. And I really think that there was a missed opportunity for that kind of storytelling that we're going to see later this season in West Palm Beach and Florida, of amalgamating those old and new voices in the community and helping them have a cultural understanding of the value of that UNESCO designation and the value of their current structure. To me, it feels like there's a breakdown in that telephone game, I guess.
Yeah, and I mean, like, and artists are always push back on like you asking them to quantify numbers about the impact of their things. They're like, oh, but even if we change 20 hearts and minds, it was all worth it. And I don't think that they, and I think that yes, it makes them feel comfortable, uncomfortable. And I understand that they want to be like the rest of the classroom, maybe. Right.
They were the special kid.
Yeah. But I think that you're right, that there was a missed opportunity in communicating to that community why it was so important that they are under economic development and how unique it is. It is so unique in the US, in Canada, in Australia. Like, it is so unique, and that is what has been allowed them to get to the place that they are.
Right. And I think that the part that we are screaming is from the outside that they are unique, but that's because their marketing has done such a great job focused on other cities, other countries, on a global, like, we're putting Austin on the global map. And I think that in doing the work that Tulsa was trying to do and getting themselves on that global map and having done that, the fault was that they lost a little bit of that community support for that system, because their education, like all marketing campaigns, was focused on bringing tourists to their location and not emboldening the local, which kind of touches on a number of what we do in recognizing the capacity of local engagement and tourism and money being touched by the same marketing efforts that external.
That's true, right? Like, the local people have to be a part of that narrative.
Right.
They have to be.
So I think that's why we have our opinion. I just want to acknowledge that, like, that's why we have our opinions, is that we've received that external marketing that the locals didn't actually.
And I think, I think that if Austin succeeds in this post-split, it'll be because of their staff. And
100%.
Yeah.
The capacity of Matthew and the team is what will make this work.
Yeah. But I do think that, like, you know, I know my creative sector. Like, there is an over reliance on, like, emotion and testimonials without pairing it with data. And I think that cities pushing creators to be a little bit uncomfortable with that is that tension is worthwhile when it makes the vibrancy that it is, you know. But they're clearly trying to build something beyond South By, right? Like, the convention center is closing over the next 2 years. You know, they're
only going to have Austin City.
This is them making their stand and saying that they are more than South By. And I think that if anything, that would be what excites me about this, like, kind of post split world, this divorce between economics and the creative department.
Yeah, I mean, I say all of these critiques, but it's because I love the city of Austin. It's been one of my favorite for us to profile, right? And to talk about as a model that works. It's been powerful to see how, like, placemaking transforms based on that community feedback. So, like, where we are seeing this late 20s, you know, development, and they've learned enough about themselves that they're going to redefine who they are as they turn 30. And that is cool. Right, we all go through that, and it's something that we can all touch and understand, and it's fascinating to watch a city also go through it when we look at them and we say, oh, they're all grown up. Well, the reality is they're still a child, they're still in their 20s, they're still figuring themselves out when it comes to this placemaking strategy that has lasted almost 2 decades, and, like, what does that look like? And
placemaking is constantly evolving, right? Like, placemaking is not stationary. The immigration patterns that will come into cities will completely change the makeup, and the old way won't fit, like, the old clothing will not fit you anymore, right? So, like the city of Austin, you know, may, and we might see that if they had stayed in their current state, that they would have been stuck in the past, and they might have started hemorrhaging.
Very fair. And I think that's why the team is so valuable, and that, like, what you said about them being the make or break is the humans who have that legacy underneath a different framework who are going to be able to make it work. I think that that's why, if I was president and I had to choose, like, 5 people to be on my cabinet, like, I would definitely be pulling from this team in Austin if I was elected tomorrow. I'd be like, hi, sorry, I know you're doing important things, but I have a country I need your help with. Come with me. And that's how I would do it, because they're so awesome, you know?
Yeah. And I know a lot of this stems from the fact that, like, Austin has historically overfunded legacy institutions. That seems to be, I don't know whether that's a Texas thing, because we heard that comment in, like, Dallas and
we did.
But I think that that's true of a lot of different places, is that, like, that overfunding of legacy institutions, and you know, that's a critique that echoes from season 1. right? And so they're trying to make this move into getting more artists, emerging artists into that fold, and not necessarily like mitigating risk by investing in institutions that may not change. And like this may be the way that they allow, like, this structure policy change allows them to keep DEI front and center without calling it that, right? Like,
right. Changing the, keeping the objective while not caring the shape it takes. If it's purple, if it's blue, if it's a triangle, if it's a square, we don't really care. The goal is that the community is involved in building the community, and it's a feedback loop between the people and the builders.
Yeah. So, I mean, if any team can pull it off, it's this team. My chips are all in their basket. Like,
cool. Well, and I'm excited to go from this week, and we're talking about like how this structural change, and then we've specifically kind of highlighted, like, oh my goodness, that communication with the community. And I'm excited because that communication with the community has been done so well by West Palm Beach. And so next week, we're going to get another little mini series within our season to really do a deep dive into what that looks like to communicate with the community and have the community communicate back and have that those thoughts revalidated. And I'm very, very excited to see what, I guess, that 32-year-old looks like in that community development space, or maybe just a peer. You know, I don't know. We haven't fully heard that next week's episode yet, but I think that it's exciting to see these different cities at these different stages of development who have filled in the pain points of one another. And next week fills in the pain point that we're seeing Austin experience in another city in the States. So.
And I know some of you who have listened to us for a little while now might be thinking to yourself, why does West Palm Beach seem familiar? Like, why does this seem familiar? It is because you've heard me talk about this Trojan Horse project so many times. And we are speaking to the ingenious placemaking expert behind that, right? That this process that could help any city in America build a community-led vision in like 2 to 6 months. It is the way cities get to being in Austin, right? Is the sorts of processes that Cheryl is putting in place in West Palm Beach. Yes, in Florida. This is happening in Florida, and she is freaking killing it. She is one of the best placemakers I know. And I'm so excited for you guys to just download all of her wisdom into your brain.
So if you haven't noticed, we have taken you from some of our favorite people to some of our most favorite people, and we shoved everybody into the season. And so Matthew and the team in the city of Austin are absolutely freaking killing it. And so as we build this cohort, we're excited to bring in next week's West Palm Beach, and we will honestly get to introduce you to all the really cool people who are doing this work that you can reach out to if you have any questions. So reach out to Matthew and his team and talk to about what a mature plan might look like and how you can follow their footsteps to get there. And next week, we'll see a whole other strategy of how you can follow footsteps as well. So excited to have you guys. Thank you so much for coming. We will see you next week in Florida.
Have a grand adventure, everyone.
The Vibrant Spaces podcast is produced by Story City. You can find our entire archive on any podcasting app and on about.storycity.app, where we publish transcripts and show notes. This episode was produced by Tim Souza, and our staff includes Justin Kahn, Brett Ludwig, and Victoria Omitska. Our theme song is Happy Indie by Alex Guz. Our co-hosts are Tim Souza and me, Emily Craven. As always, thank you for listening. We hope you have a glorious adventure this week.